Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. This is Joe Cordell. With me, Susan Arthur. Susan, this week we're going to start a two-week series on wills and trusts. Now, I'm concerned that we have people, even as I completed that sentence, reaching for the dial on the radio.
Oh, no. They're going to talk about
now,
that.
Now, talk about the magnitude of this problem.
All right. Well, I think this is a huge problem. Listen to these statistics. 64% of Americans don't even have a will. Now you think, okay, well, that's probably all Americans. That's some young people. They don't have one either. Uh-oh, not off the hook. 70% of those 45 to 54, and now we're getting a little bit older, 54%, more than half of those age 55 to 64 do not have a will. And then, you know, there are plenty of people who are having some health issues. Unexpected things happen in their life. We simply have got to pay attention to these things. And the biggest reason people say they don't, they just didn't get around to it. 60% of the people say, well, I just didn't get around to it. And 27% don't think it's urgent at all.
Well,
now, as a lawyer, what does that make you do?
Well, you know, I guess when it's like having health insurance when you're under 30. Yeah, some percent of those people, it's true, are going to come down with some horrendous disease that will bankrupt them. Well, more likely bankrupt their parents.
Right.
But what about, though, the fact that if we're talking about mainly under 30-year-olds and they don't have a will, I'm not speaking approvingly, and I don't think it's a good policy, but yeah, I get that. I understand at least their reasoning. Now, as you get older, though, we know those risks increase. And if these statistics really meant, Susan, if I were to interpret this as I would prefer to do, interpret this data as say, well, the reason they don't have a will is because they have something better than a will, which we'll talk about today, what those alternatives might be, especially we'll talk about trust. But I don't think that's the point.
That's not
of this
the point
study.
Of this, I don't think.
No. I understand. It's to say that people haven't gotten around to it. And, you know, some people don't go to the dentist because, you know, it's unpleasant.
You might find a cavity.
Yeah, it's unpleasant and it's a hassle and it's a distraction from other stuff. And I don't have a toothache today. So I think that there's a little bit of that same reasoning. And it is. It's very frustrating because we know that some substantial portion of these people will die before they get around to something that they'll tell you now that their intention is to do.
Well, and 70% of those 45 to 54 don't have a will. Those are the people that have small children. Those are the people that have kids at home. You've got to take care of that kind of stuff.
So it's true that it is an obligation. It's the responsible thing to do. And it's the thing that you should grab yourself by the shoulders and shake yourself and say, get this done. So we're not necessarily advocates of a will, and you'll see that as we go along this discussion, but we're advocates of having something in place. That's the point, is you got to have something in place. So let's start with what happens if you don't have anything in place. We might as well deal with what we started out with.
Right.
Well, that's called intestate succession. And it means that the state will decide where those things go. Now, it's something that can be predicted because there are rules of descendancy by which decisions are made as who comes first and what percentages, et cetera. Now, there's some chance that that would correspond to what you would want. But there's also a greater chance that that will not correspond to what you want. And the bottom line is the state will decide that, not you, and it still means this sort of probate process. So there will be delay and there will be expense. Let's talk about what probate is.
Okay.
I'm going to be devil's advocate for a minute. Those of you listening, I can make an argument to where I think you'll agree that it's important for probate to exist. Going back, I don't know, 600 plus years, we have the experience of the civil law system that evolved in England. And literally, you study cases that cite authority from the years of the 14th century. And that's shocking to think that you could have principles, hoary principles that were laid down that long ago and that still govern our conduct today. But it's true. And in a way, that's testimony to the fact that these are fundamental enduring truths. So let me tell you one of these fundamental enduring truths. There is this uncanny certainty that when someone has died since time immemorial, shortly thereafter, usually within days, if not hours, someone comes running into a nearby courthouse, waving a piece of paper over their head and saying that this paper reflects the final wishes of this person who's just passed. And as luck would have it, almost invariably, it turns out that this piece of paper, in fact, intends to give the property and everything they own to the person in whose hand was that document was waving.
Sounds a little bit like a movie I've seen.
Yeah. So it's because of the experience that was born of this time and time again, and the fact that when you're dead, is there any time when you're more vulnerable?
No.
Than when you're 6 feet under the ground to fraud. So what the probate process represents is really this experience of man that says that we have to be especially careful. We have to have lots of roadblocks, lots of guardrails, lots of cautionary signage to assure that what somebody wants to happen when they're gone in fact happens after they're gone. In other words, when they have no ability to assure, really it's an act of trust. And so since the 14th century, the English common law system, which we have since inherited here in no more area than this testimony than in the area of estate law as well as real estate and property law, all of which is at issue often in these cases. So anyway, That is the fundamental concern about probate. It's to assure that anything that purports to be the will of this person, or in the absence of a will, then different issues are attended, not the expression of intent, but instead to assure that property goes to the right people. So probate is to assure, though, where there is a will, that this is the correct will. So that's the reason that many of you, kind of maybe some of those who don't get wills drafted, They dread the fact that there's this very ceremonial process. They have to go into a lawyer's office. They have to have witnesses. Maybe the lawyer doesn't have the witnesses that day. They've got to have a notary. And heaven forbid they've ordered this online. And now they're given these elaborate instructions that they're following, assuring that it's executed correctly. And someone might just throw their hands up to the heavens and say, why is this so complicated? And keep in mind, you know, that the experience of those centuries in which people have attempted to defraud the dead. And believe it or not, I know this will shock everyone listening, sometimes it's family members. I know you don't, I suspect
no,
many of you are
saying
that can't be, but I'm telling you, at the risk of bursting your bubble, it's more likely within the home than outside it. Now, occasionally it's someone that was introduced to the home very recently, of whom there might be decades difference in age between this person and the decedent. And there's a good chance that they're the opposite gender. But despite all that, we have these rules in probate. Because of all that, we have these rules in probate that are intended to protect the intentions of all of us when we go. So we're all glad that these rules exist from that perspective. So one other important purpose of probate. Probate is to assure that everyone gets paid who has lent money to somebody who dies. Now, surely you would not have thought, if you're engaged in a business and you sell products or services to someone, you would not think of yourself as essentially an insurer that they will survive long enough to pay you. In other words, your sale is contingent on this person living to repay you. And if they don't, then of course they would owe you nothing. And no one does business with someone with that expectation. We all expect to be paid. We're not guarantors of people's longevity. And as a result, whenever someone goes out of the world, if they're like Americans, especially Americans, especially Americans today versus right. 100 years,
a few
ago,
years ago,
how many people left this world 100 years ago in America owing any, some people nothing?
Oh,
I mean,
right.
owing nothing yeah. to anyone.
I'm sure a huge number, more than today,
yeah,
would be
yeah.
my guess. I could be wrong. But
And thinking though, think about those Depression-era people. First of all,
right.
they didn't have a lot.
Right.
But I assure you, they didn't have a lot of debt either.
And they saved it all.
Yeah, yeah. We were not so much a consumer-driven culture, but now we are. And so when people die, they leave the world with lots of creditors, most people. And these creditors are entitled to be paid. So another purpose of probate is to assure before any assets are distributed, any changes take place in any assets, that creditors get paid. So you may say, well, why? Okay, fine. We're wanting to assure that all this is done correctly, that we have a legitimate will, properly signed, it's properly interpreted. Another consideration, interpreting what the will means, mm-hmm. even when you know it's real. And then assuring that these creditors get paid. Why can't this be done in a week or 2 weeks? Well, a couple answers to that question. One, of course, is that the no court system
is that
efficient.
It?
That's one answer, is that it's just sheer inefficiency. But it's bigger than that, much bigger than that. You have to have periods of time that are reasonable for people to be contacted. Now, this invites the mischief that is associated with probate. Now, I've already persuaded you that probate is something that serves, albeit grudgingly, a good purpose. But you probably also became convinced along the way that this sounds like this is going to take a lot of time. There's going to be money involved and delay. And yes, all those things are correct. The delay is to give reasonable notification to people to step forward, especially creditors, but also other claimants. Now remember, if you're going to have a truly bona fide process to assure that the intended people, parties, get the goods that are willed, and then you have to give them notice. So who would be entitled to notice? The people who would be the recipients according to the laws of intestate succession. I hope I didn't lose anybody at this point. I just sense anytime I use that many multi-syllable words in a row, I assume that whoever I'm talking to is going to be their minds.
Intestate what?
Well, so all that's saying is, anybody who might get the stuff, if the will turns out to be invalid, they're entitled to be notified. Now, is that an invitation to a problem? It is. Does that sort of invite litigation or conflict or maybe instill in somebody an idea that they didn't otherwise have? Yeah, 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 to all those things. So some people don't like probate simply because of it is fraught with potential for conflict, and it is. And there's also the issue about the delay. Now, for creditors and these others to come forward, you can't give them 10 days.
Right.
Now, maybe we could, but that's not considered reasonable. So one thing that you have to do as to creditors is run an ad in the state of Missouri for 6 months.
Oh, my.
Yeah, 6 months in a legal periodical. So during the 6-month period of time, it's supposed to give a reasonable opportunity for anyone with a claim. Now, again, being devil's advocate, you know, we're talking about what could be hundreds of thousands of dollars of a claim. So for someone to feel protected when they lend that sort of money or when they otherwise engage in transactions with someone, all of us of whom could die and will. So they should have a reasonable belief that they're going to have time to find out and to step forward. Because remember, if they don't step forward in that 6-month period of time and the assets are distributed, it's gone. You know, each of the heirs or the beneficiaries now have each gone their own way, and they have the money now.
So you're looking at least a 6-month delay, just simply for the notification from the time that the person passes away.
And that's just the notification. That's only after you've already commenced the estate and there's been other notifications. So give it closer to a year, 6 months to a year. If you want to wonder how much you're going to spend for this endeavor, you simply go to the statute and you check under Missouri and you can look under will statute fees. And if you type that in Google, I'm sure it'll deliver you to the proper passage in the state statute. And there's a calendar or schedule there rather that prescribes what percentages can be charged at different levels by, on the one hand, the personal representative, which turns out to be the same amount that's charged by an attorney. And that percentage goes down as the amounts go up. I think it starts at 5% of the estate, and then at a certain threshold, it goes to 4% and then to 3%. And then at some point, I think it becomes 2%. But I can tell you that those numbers add up very quickly. And let me tell you, if you have any estate of any size, significant size whatsoever, then I can almost assure you that you would be far better off to use an alternative to a will and incur that additional cost, which probably will come with that. I'll talk more about that in a second if we have time. Then to pay the cost of the will.
Yeah, just a quick Google search. 5% for the first $5,000, 4% for the next $20,000, 3% for the next $75,000. So it can add up pretty quickly.
And then above 75?
Above 75, we go 2.75 for the next $300,000.
Yeah, so do some quick math and calculate how quickly that adds up to tens of thousands of dollars.
Well,
and you don't have to be rich.
A house could be, $300,000. I mean, some homes are
easily.
Easily that.
And we're not assuming rich people. My clientele as an elder lawyer is typically people whose assets are, I don't know, roughly in the ballpark of $300,000 to maybe a little over $1 million. We have some clients who are affluent, but our core clientele are people who are in the middle class. And for most of those people, if they do that math, they will find out that even when they're being given numbers that they often are, for example, by for revocable trusts and for devices such as that, that they're still way ahead. And it makes no sense, because you can get a will properly done, and let me emphasize that, as opposed to getting a form and filling it out, but to have a will that properly reflects your goals and objectives, then you're going to easily spend then $500. If you're getting a will for less than $500, let me say this to those of you listening. If you're getting a will for less than $500, you should be suspicious that you're getting a form. I mean, think about it. A lawyer is going to have some expectation of around $300 an hour income, ballpark, $250, some $375, some $400. And I assume in all those cases it corresponds to their experience and et cetera. So these lawyers, whether they're telling you this or not, if they're quoting you anything less than $500, then they must be spending very little time outside your presence, because you're probably going to occupy an hour and a half of their time. And if you don't, you should be worried.
How can
they possibly know what you want without I'm talking about a meaningful discussion.
I was just going to say, you have to have a conversation. I mean, you have to be able to have someone ask you those questions and say, okay, have you thought about this? What about that? I mean, there are so many things that in your experience, you're going to think about that I'm going to be, oh, I didn't even think about that one. I need to double check that.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll grant you that I don't want to make any fully sweeping statements, and almost any statement I make on this show is going to be a generalization, just because it would vary among many of you. And I'll say this, if you're under 30 and you don't have a lot in this world, okay, I get that. So if you were my son or daughter, I have two daughters that are in their early 20s, then sure, a will, everything to mom and dad, everything to dad, actually.
Wait, but mom might have something to say about that.
And be done with it. And I get that. So a form for that purpose, I probably wouldn't argue with at all. My purpose on here really is not to argue why you should give lawyers a lot of money. I can afford to be objective on this show, and I am. So I would say to you that if you have very few assets in this world, and you don't have anybody with a special need or a special circumstance, then okay, then maybe it makes sense.
Maybe the online form is really okay for you.
Yeah. And let me argue this too, that if you have less than, I think now they've raised the threshold to 50,000. In the state of Missouri, it was 40 for small estate administration. So if you're somebody who has assets below that ceiling, then again, a will is not that big of a problem, because it has a streamlined process where things can get done very quickly and very effectively. So I wouldn't argue with it in that case. Again, it's not just the money. It's two pieces at that point. One piece is you don't have much money in terms of assets. But the other piece is that you don't have any special circumstances where you're really concerned about the way that money is spent or conditions on how it's used, et cetera. But for the vast majority of other people, certainly most of the people listening to this show are over 60. I know that because we're a senior show. We're an elder talk show. So for almost without exception for the people I'm listening to, except those below that $40,000 or so threshold, and maybe some of them for the reason I just mentioned, you should be taking seriously your estate planning. And that, with rare exception, it's going to mean including some sort of trust.
Okay, so let's turn the corner a little bit and let's look at trusts. Now, there are two types of trusts that I know we've talked about before.
Yes, there are. There's revocable and irrevocable. And I wish I had I like to have these conversations on a whiteboard in which I can kind of make circles. But I think I can communicate this. And some of you have some rough familiarity with a trust. And think of it as nothing more than this device by which you say to someone else, I want to give you some assets for you to manage on behalf of certain beneficiaries, certain other people. And the classic scenario and the easiest one to talk about this is as it pertains to, for example, children. Mm-hmm. Let's assume that you're a parent, you have minor children, and you want to plan for them. So one way to do that, if you wanted to plan while you're alive, then you would transfer assets to someone as trustee. That's the name of their position. And the trustee holds the assets in trust. That's a legal term, in trust, for certain named beneficiaries. In essence, that's what a trust is. And in its barest terms, that's what it is. Now, whenever you create this relationship with this person who's to act as the trustee, they become what the law calls a fiduciary. And that's a very, very solemn responsibility. It means that all these duties attach and all these consequences attach. It's not a casual thing. But it's something in which they have the highest and greatest responsibility the law recognizes.
And there are consequences if they don't act according to your benefit. Is that correct?
Yeah, and depending on what those were, they're criminal as well as civil. So it is a serious thing. And the reason it is because we've decided that trusts are incredibly useful devices. Again, this too goes back to the 15th century. That's when trusts first appeared. They were called uses. And at the time, the trusts were the way in which someone could transfer land to people they love. You couldn't have a normal transfer of land because there were special rules about it. So in order for you to accomplish that in a feudal system with Henry VIII or whatnot in charge, then you would use the church. And the church became this device by which you would transfer assets, and they would undertake this feudal oath, essentially, to care for your intended beneficiaries. And that evolved eventually into the secular device called a trust, uses. And now we are with the fundamentals are the same. But here's what's so great about trust, in addition to the fact that you have longevity. I mean, you have a plan that can survive not only you, but your children and your children's children. So you have what's called a dynasty trust available if you want. Now, some of you are thinking, wait, I have $100,000. I'm not interested in a dynasty trust. I get it, and probably not with $100,000. But you don't have to have $100 million. You don't even have to have $10 million. And we've had clients set up trusts that are multi-generation with $1 million. So don't think that a trust that's designed to benefit not only your children but your grandchildren and maybe even their children, don't think that that's a crazy idea if you have, you know, less than $500,000. It just depends on how you intended the money to be used. So the other piece of this picture is that you get to prescribe the rules. So it's not just that you hand the money to this person called a trustee and say, hey, take care of my beneficiaries. Here's their names and addresses, et cetera. it's not just that. You get to prescribe rules.
So these trust fund babies that we heard about, they just didn't have a lot of rules sometimes.
Well, they didn't have enough rules. or they had lawyers that were smarter than the lawyers for the trustee. I don't know. But the point is, you get to set the rules. And that's one of the beauties of a trust, is that not only do you sidestep probate, which incidentally, many people I would have sold it simply on that.
Right.
But really, that's the least exciting thing about a trust. Yes, I would mention it. Does that alone justify the additional money you're going to spend on a trust? I would argue yes, for the vast majority of people who are listening today. That alone, if you do the math based on the calculations we just gave you, you can look them up. Yeah, that alone should make clear to you that there's a huge difference in terms of savings. But I'm least interested in that. Having said that, I'd rather move on and talk about how cool a trust is.
Talk about the positives?
Yeah. I mean, it you can accomplish so much with it. And now that I've kind of laid down that sort of format, now I can add this twist to it. Often the way people create trusts is they put themselves initially in all three roles. Because if I'd started out with that, people would have said, huh, why would you, you know, have these three names for yourself?
Okay, so they put themselves, and let's just review, as trustee, as, tell me again.
As beneficiary.
Beneficiary.
And they're the what do you call them, a trustor, call them a grantor.
The guarantee.
The people who create the trust. So they are occupying all three roles. They're creating the trust. They're also going to be the trustee, and they're also the beneficiary. Now, imagine, though, as I've just described this, imagine, though, for the trustee that you have different layers. And so that when one person dies or resigns, it just automatically clicks down to the next layer. And then when that person dies or resigns, it clicks down to the next layer. Imagine that process both for the trustee and the beneficiary, because that's what happens is the beauty of creating a trust with you starting out in these roles is that you know that when there's a time when you cannot do one of those roles, then automatically, without your having to take any action whatsoever, the next person will succeed to that position. So let's assume that you've created a revocable living trust. This is a trust, as the term implies. You can change it, blow it up, do anything you want with it. So you've created this trust. You're out having dinner. In your case, it'd have to be many years from now. But anyway, so you're out having dinner and you have a stroke. So as dinner started, you were the trustee and you were the beneficiary of your trust, right?
Right.
And of course, you had created it. By the time you would have otherwise finished dinner or soon thereafter, you're no longer the trustee. And the reason you're no longer the trustee is that you have become, for my example, incompetent.
Right.
Now, are you still the beneficiary? Remember, I described the process by which you have succession into both of these roles. And yes, you are, because the triggering event for changing beneficiaries is death. So as long as you're alive, you're the only beneficiary, or you and your husband, however you choose to define that. So what's happened is you're still the beneficiary, but now, because you're no longer competent, you've had a process by which that transition takes place. Two doctors certify, one doctor certify. I mean, you define that process. No one else has to. But however you have defined it, let's assume that it kicked in, and so you have your successor trustee. It could be a brother. It could be a child, your daughter, son, whoever.
Wouldn't normally be a spouse.
It often is.
It often is a spouse,
yeah. And as a matter of fact, in that case, your spouse is often a co-trustee if it's a joint trust. So they don't have to replace your position. They continue on as a single trustee. But I'm assuming you as an individual to make this point. So you would pass, and then automatically the next layer for trustee would click down. Now you have two or three layers there, because you anticipate this is designed not only to survive your incompetence, meaning you reach this point where you can't manage for yourself, but it's intended to survive your death. And so you've put in place this automatic provision for the care of the people you value which are the beneficiaries. You are at that first layer, but just like above with the trustees, except when you die, and then the next layer of beneficiaries step forward. They're eligible now to receive the benefits of the trust, and those will typically be your children or your surviving spouse, as the case may be. And then you can even provide for an additional generation. So it's just a wonderful tool in which you get to lay down rules that are not controlling from the grave. Some people, you know, feel that if they have any conditions or if they include anything other than simply having the personal representative write a check, that it's controlling from the grave.
I think
that's a gross disservice to their loved ones. I can provide for my daughters much better by thinking about a trust in which I can have terms and conditions that will allow them to have better protection for their assets than they could give themselves. By designing the trust properly, I can assure that their assets will be protected from creditors, mm-hmm. that creditors will never be able to sue them for this. I can assure that if they ever had to qualify for long-term care, that ever their children wanted to get loans for college, that they would qualify because these assets would never be considered as their assets. Hmm. And heaven forbid if my daughters ever got divorced, mm-hmm. that these assets would never be a marital asset. I can accomplish so much for the people I care about with a trust that I never could with a will. And it's just, it would almost be too lazy for me to simply put a provision that, yeah, have my personal representative just write a check, you know, take the number, divide it in two, and write two checks, I'm done.
You hear lots of people who get in trouble that way.
And particularly when I know what lies ahead. And I know, for example, there's a 50% chance of a divorce. How many people listening to me right now have had someone in the family, perhaps, who has been divorced and there was a gift from their parents or an inheritance that suddenly went in part, probably 50%, to the now divorced in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so common with Cordell and Cordell. We see that regularly. Our lawyers are trained to be able to go in, subpoena the records, and look at those gifts that were made to wives by parents, mm-hmm. or inheritances, and to examine exactly how that money was handled. And it's very difficult to keep that money as a separate asset. I won't say impossible, but I'll say that our attorneys generally get some part of it declared as our clients. And that's because assets have a tendency to become marital assets. It's a predisposition of assets. The court's view often is to be welcoming to those arguments. And why would you ever want to subject that risk to your children? And that's just on that subject.
Mm-hmm.
You choose the other subjects. Bankruptcy, that could happen. It may not be your children's fault.
Hmm.
A lawsuit, a car accident.
I was going to say medical expenses often will wipe out a family.
Medical expenses. I mean, we could go on and on. And those things are all, when I say fixable, I mean you can create this sort of Teflon container, this marvelous container that will assure, as long as your children are properly taught, that they don't connive to get the assets out, because this is not a container that I'm imagining was created because of my distrust to my children. It's created as a gift to them,
mm-hmm.
a gift that gives them far more than the money's worth. And they can't create it for themselves. That's what those of you listening need to understand, is that you can't go out and create for yourself something as resistant to all these threats that I just described, because what you would create would be called self-settled. And it's called a self-settled trust. And again, step back and just use common sense. Can you not understand why juries and judges view with skepticism somebody who's sued or who is in a divorce, certainly, but in any context, and they say, oh, sorry, last month I put my assets in such and such, and they're no longer available for you, with a smirk.
Yeah.
And I'm just saying, self-settled trusts, even asset protection trusts, are much more limited in their potential than is a trust that is of which you are a recipient. If your parent gives you a trust, it's called a third-party trust. And that's what I'm describing can be created here. Should we take a break?
We should.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be back in a few minutes to continue talking about wills and trusts.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors. Presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA, Joe Cordell.
Okay, we're back with Elder Talk. Before we went into the break, we were talking about wills versus trusts, and I was making the argument that you can accomplish some really cool things with trusts. And I think that I communicated, I hope, kind of the basic moving parts of a trust, and I think I have. So it's not a complicated thing, but it does mean that you need to think about who would be your successor trustees. Mm-hmm. And who would be the beneficiaries that you would have in mind once you and or your spouse is gone. And from there, you can play with it in a lot of ways. You can create lots of cool benefits. You can have conditions that have to happen for certain things. One thing that I see is sometimes spouses will they'll create a trust between the two of them. And it may be a joint trust. Sometimes we do sort of two trusts that kind of balance out the assets, but very similar thing either way. And they'll want a provision that at the death of the first, certain assets lock down, or there are some rules. Now, those of you who have been married for 40 years, maybe 60 years, and you're thinking, no, I don't get that. You know, why would my husband distrust me, or why would my wife distrust me? And I don't think that it's that so much as making assumptions that life goes on. And depending on when your spouse dies, if you're 50, I know it's asking something heroic of us, especially men, to hope that our wives would not be alone the rest of their lives. But I mean, whether we are quite that selfless on it or not, we should at least be willing to recognize the possibility.
I went to a wedding where the groom was 74.
I'll see. And we shouldn't assume that those are often mistakes. Sometimes we immediately jump to the conclusion that, whoops, you know, somebody has made a bad decision or been taken advantage of. Not necessarily. So I'm merely pointing out that depending on when death occurred, I would concede to you in a moment that if death occurred and you're both over 80, the chances of remarriage are much lower. That may be a risk you figure I'll assume. Some people wouldn't assume that risk, incidentally, but I get the argument. But when you're doing your planning, depending on your age, you may want to allow for the possibility that one of you will have a stroke and maybe your surviving wife is 65. And I think you have to allow for the possibility at that point that she will remarry. So whenever you're doing planning, this is my only point, is I think it's incumbent on you to at least talk about, do you want to have something that provides more confidence for the children that somebody won't intervene perhaps in a manipulative way to upset that plan?
Well, and you know, we've all been in situations or have friends where maybe someone marries a little later and the new spouse makes decisions. And even if they are not malicious, the children don't agree with them. And you've created all kinds of grief and consternation. And when dad gets sick and now she's taking care of him, I mean, I have seen it up close and personal in a lot of different situations.
Yeah. And what about those cases, though, where people are in a mixed sort of, or a blended family, mm-hmm. I'll say. You have children of dad, children of mom, maybe children of both. Mm-hmm. But depending on when they married, it's just children of mom, children of dad. So that's a situation that really we didn't envision a lot in the law in the 15th century.
Right.
and for a long time, that wasn't an issue. So when you're doing your estate planning as a married couple, and you know that situation exists, not prospectively in the future, it exists now. And to not have a plan that reflects the possible issues that might come after the death of one of you, I think is just not responsible. Sometimes we call it the last spouse standing rule, because that determines whose kids end up with the assets. And this is not to demonize the surviving spouse. It's to say that there may be a lot of road covered after this person's gone. And a lot of things can happen along that road that can be interpreted both ways. Mm-hmm. And it may be that this surviving spouse feels righteous indignation at something that these stepkids did or failed to do. So these are all reasons to think about your plan and to allow for the foreseeable risk to be covered. It's enough that that there are some risks we'll never conceive of. But those we can easily conceive of, we need to consider and incorporate in some way. So different clients deal with this different ways. So some people, they assume the risk, and I get that with a surviving spouse. But again, it based on circumstances. Should we talk about cost?
We should. It's something most people don't like to talk about, but we need to know.
I hate to do this just because, and a lot of the lawyers refuse to do this just because of the wide variability out there. But this is like I tell some of our lawyers at Cordell & Cordell. We used to have this conversation when I was practicing primarily there. And I always said, well, let's go out on a limb and estimate what fees will be. Because if you were the client and you were sitting there asking, how much is this, in that case, divorce going to cost, you would want the lawyer to be kind enough to give you an answer, to go out on a limb at the risk that you may later, you know, yell in their face and say, you know, you're off by $10,000. But still, you want them to go out on that limb. You want a doctor. You want a doctor to go out on a limb and tell you what he or she really thinks, and not just dispense the advice their lawyer suggests they give. So I have that same spirit here, is to say that, you know, let's give our best estimate based on our experience, and it can be wrong. Now, this is easier to estimate because this is not litigation. So that, you know, we're talking about predictable fees.
Right.
And clients will know on the front end wherever they go what those will be. But I think if you went to most estate planning lawyers or elder lawyers and if they have some experience, I think they're probably going to quote you somewhere about north of $1,500 for a trust, I would think. And probably a little north of $2,000 even. And depending on if you're wealthy and it's complicated, and those of you who fit that description, you know who you are, where it's a very complicated situation and various limited partnerships or various entities, then of course you're north of that. But I'm thinking about the average person listening. So I would expect to spend north of $1,500, maybe not much north, and maybe in that ballpark itself.
I think it's a cost risk versus benefit type of thing. Sure, it might be a little bit more on the front end, but you're probably going to save a lot more in the end.
Yeah, and I'm just impatient with whether it's a family member or someone else who says, well, you know, I can get a will for $300 or $400 or $500 even. And heaven forbid, if they tell me anything below that, I'm really impatient with it. I know they're just filling out a form. Now, again, if it's somebody under 30, 35 years old, have no assets, no kids, I get it. But otherwise, I mean, to be pinching nickels regarding your legacy, regarding whatever you've accomplished in this world, really it relates to your last third of your life here, number one, if you're talking about a trust versus a will. A trust renders benefits while you're alive. A will, of course, speaks at death, is the famous phraseology. So a trust is something that will start taking care of you while you're alive, and then it will continue in existence for those you care about when you're gone. And if the difference between $300 or $500 and $1,500 is a deal killer, it says something unflattering. And again, I'll direct this more at a family member than at any of you. But my point is, I feel like I can say that to somebody I care about and love. I feel like I can say that I think this is irresponsible and it's a bad decision. As to the those of you listening, you know, you have to make that decision. But I think for whether you spend $1,500 or you spend $2,500 or even as much as $3,000, you know, keep in mind that this is something that provides dramatically better options than the alternative. So there, I've told you. But go talk to your lawyers about this. Argue with them about the price. I've played my role in giving you a heads up, and they can defend their numbers from there. Anyway, we've covered a lot of material, Susan. And next week, we're going to pick up with the topic of trust.
We are.
Except we're going to shift from, this week we kind of dealt primarily with revocable. Next week we're going to shift to the subject of irrevocable. And the irrevocable is a little more complicated topic. It won't apply to all of you, but I think you'll find it interesting. So I look forward to your tuning in next week. This has been another episode of Elder Talk. Take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. That's eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.